It is Saturday, December 15th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news and making electronic things talk. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today we're covering the week in geek news, and in the second half we have Professor Tom Igo to talk about creating electronics that communicate. His book is called Making Things Talk. It's all about smart electronics, talking. Well, more like jabbering. You'll learn all about it. It's kind of exciting. During the second half of the show, welcome to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you like. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now and send us email.
Tune in Tuesday morning for the Astronomy Call-In on Talk of the Bay. Astronomers Greg Laughlin and Steve Vogt spend their lives hunting down planets. Call 1-800-655-5877 before or during the show to submit your astronomy questions. That's the Astronomy Call-In Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. on Talk of the Bay, Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio.
Geeks. Thank you, Sean.
I read it as it is.
Geek Speak on KOSP, supported by Cruise Air, providing local internet services, including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise Air memberships available online at cruiseair.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Lyle.
And Ben Jaffe, a geek and student.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ben. Let's go ahead and start off, Sean, with you.
Yeah, I've got a great question or a great story here. Okay. So, I guess last year UPS decided to maybe make their software a little more sophisticated and eliminate left-hand turns for their UPS drivers.
What?
Because, you know, when you sit there in the left-hand turn lane, you're idling, you're wasting time, and you're burning gas. Not a big deal, you know, for any typical person, but when you're talking about a fleet of 95,000 trucks,
that's
you know,
trucks.
That could be a problem. So it looks like it's paid off. Anybody want to take a guess?
Well, first off, they have, like, GPS systems that tell them where to go, like, actually where to drive.
Yeah, they've got really nice software that maps out exactly where packages need to be delivered. Probably they know every package you have on that truck, right?
Right, of course.
So they map out routes for everything, and you just drive those routes.
I didn't know that.
And it even takes into account that sometimes the circuitous route that would be taken from not making a left-hand turn is longer. So go ahead and make the left-hand turn. I guess really, really smart software. So we're talking about they shaved about 28.5 million miles off its delivery routes.
In a year?
In a year.
Wow.
They saved roughly 3 million gallons of gas and reduced CO2 emissions by 31,000 metric tons.
Wow. That's pretty cool, just from a software design.
I thought that was a cool
story. Now that's good software.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Thank you very much, Sean. All right, Ben, what's going on with spam?
Spam. So every year, Barracuda Networks publishes an annual spam report. And in 2007... 90 to 95% of all email sent was spam.
95%, man, that's ridiculous.
Jeez.
And you know, it's
and the
funny.
Year's not even over yet.
And, yeah, exactly. and you know, it's funny. 2002, Lyle. I guess how much was spam?
I don't know. 95%.
No, 5.
Only 5% was 5%.
Spam. 5%. Oh, sorry, 2001.
2001. Oh, yeah, 2001 was a good year.
In 2001.
Really? Only 5%?
Yeah, so in six years.
I've always thought spam was high, so it's gotten that much worse.
Well, I mean, also our spam filtering has gotten better and better and better.
Right, right. So we're not seeing the stuff we actually get.
Exactly.
That's horrible.
Yeah. So there's your downer for the
Thanks a lot. You know, I haven't looked at my... I stopped looking at my spam folder. I stopped like overviewing it.
Yeah.
Now if it gets in there, sorry.
It's wishful thinking that you can go through all of it.
And that you can find anything. I can't find anything.
That's funny. You're right. I never looked through
my
spam.
Do you look? Yeah. Right.
Never.
Well, you know, my spam catch makes sure not to include my address book entries, which is the most important thing. So if you have communicated with me in the past, I value my address book and you're going to be able to communicate. But man, you changed your email address, forget about it.
Yeah. Getting that first message in with you, Lyle.
Yeah, you might want to call. Yeah, you might want to call me.
Do you continue to add names to your address book?
Yeah. Anytime I'm pretty religious about that. Yeah. My address book entry, you know, is great. I use the software on my laptop. I sync it to my phone, and I'm even able to share it by sending, you know, the V card stuff to other people. So yeah, it's pretty good.
And also I'm not
great about updating my Google spam checking software. I don't always upload my address book to that. I guess I should.
Same here. I use Apple Mail, and I recently found out that a couple emails just weren't getting uploaded to my mail account, and they were sitting in my Google spam folder. 4 email messages, all legitimate, in like 6 months.
Yeah, that's not enough to even care.
Yeah, well, actually, someone called me. I was like, I haven't heard back from you. I've sent
give you money
3
and
messages.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
I rely on my BlackBerry and my work spam.
Yeah.
You know, they catch spam really well.
It's great.
But for my personal, I use Gmail ever since GeekSpeak server crashed and our own email servers have gone away.
Hey, there is mail still being forwarded.
It is, yeah. But, you know, Gmail does a pretty decent job of catching spam.
It does. Especially if you update that address book, it'll make sure those aren't
I never
negatives.
Update that address book. I never even thought about it.
Well, the thing is, you're giving Google all your contact information. Do you really want to do that? It's a whole privacy issue.
There's one more thing that the study asked people what they thought was the worst form of junk advertisement. 57% of respondents said that spam was the worst. Only 31 said that postal junk mail was, and only 12% chose telemarketing. And I'm sure that if you went back to 2001 or even like 2004, you know, people would say, I'd rather not be called at home. I'd rather get a bunch of junk mail. But now a lot more people are
hating spam.
Yeah, opting for if they had a choice, you know.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'd rather have spam than someone calling my house.
Speaking of calling your house,
please hold for a very important call. I mean, what? What is that about?
But you just hang up the phone.
It's the worst.
Speaking of calling your house, I haven't been able to call your house for weeks because you've been so busy with a new product at NVIDIA.
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah. Well, we got some stuff coming out next week I can't talk about. Well, next Friday, remind me. We'll talk about those. But this week we did announce a technology called three-way SLI.
What's SLI?
So SLI is a technology that allows you to take multiple graphics cards and connect them together and take advantage of the performance boost for games.
Right. So that the graphics cards combine to make a more powerful graphics card.
Yeah, yeah. They scale.
And they're mostly used for like higher resolution monitors.
You really need a higher resolution monitor, especially with our new three-way SLI technology that takes 3 very high-end graphics cards, extremely high-end graphics cards, and combines them in such a way that it gives you, if you've got a 30-inch flat panel, the resolution on that is 2560 by 1600.
That's really good.
So with these 3 cards, you can pretty much drive, you know,
modern video games
at
high resolution.
At that resolution with anti-aliasing.
How many times
anti-aliasing gets rid of the jaggies? Yeah, really? So 4 times anti-aliasing means it goes back over that screen 4 times each frame of the game.
And blurs the and
gets
rid of
and smooths them out. Yeah, it makes a big difference and makes things look so much better. So they do this. We do this at 60 frames a second, and it's kind of interesting. It's called alternate frame rendering technology, where each graphics card is rendering a frame. So the first graphics card renders the first frame, the second frame, and the third card does the third frame, and then they all get sent out to your monitor.
Oh, that's cool.
This is
what happens when you have a lot of processing happening on your graphics card. Your frame rate slows down. It crawls down slower and slower. So this basically makes your speed 3 times faster?
Well, we're saying about 2.8 on some games.
There was a great article, I guess, when you get the URL up on the GeekSpeak site, a great article reviewing. Who's the person that did that article that reviewed the different games and what these three cards did?
Yeah, I sent an article to the Geeks. That's right. It was Ryan Shrout from PC Perspective. I think he writes great articles. He's a very sharp guy, great insight. Yeah, we should put all that up.
Yeah,
I would like to send people to his site because he just has really good stuff to say.
Yeah, I liked how he wrote. One of the things he did is kind of compared at lower resolutions adding these three cards, and it turns out that at the lower resolutions of like a standard, 1024, for example, the cards actually overhead. You don't get much performance out of it.
Yeah,
in fact,
not
you
at all.
Decrease performance because you have more overhead.
You know, it's funny in the games industry. Reviewers like to run 3D Mark 06 from Future Mark. We've had them on the show before.
Yeah.
And 3D Mark's an amazing benchmark. In fact, it's so nice looking that you kind of wish it were a game. So you run this benchmark, and at standard resolution, which is 1280, we have 1024, not that high. When you're running multiple video cards, it doesn't make any difference because you just don't need that graphics processing power. You're actually what's called more CPU bound at lower resolutions.
Oh, really?
So if you were to upgrade your CPU, then you would actually see a bump in performance.
Cool.
But to take advantage of multiple GPUs, you've actually got to increase the resolution. It's for the people with a lot of money.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland. Thanks to you, Sean, for the little bit of news. And especially with three-way SLI, is there any time soon they'll be able to see it in action, like locally?
Yeah, come over to my house.
Yeah, right on. That's the invite, Lake. And Ben, thanks for covering some of the news.
Sure.
And stay with us. We're going to go from talking a lot about software and computers to talking about devices that are kind of integrated and specifically making electronics. Professor Tom Igo hails from the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU. Sean, you might be familiar with that. Our own very own geek, Dee Dee Hubbard, went to school there and got her master's there. And Tom... His focus is on physical computing, and Tom's recent book, Making Things Talk, is a guide to using microcontrollers and communication protocols to let homemade electronics talk to computers and the internet. Tom Igo, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
So, Tom, you're sitting in New York. You're actually at NYU, Tisch School of the Arts, and you said there's some stuff going on down the hall and people might be harassing you. What are people working on right now around you?
Well, actually, I'm not at NYU. I'll be at NYU later this afternoon. I'm actually at a... small group here that's called the Hack Lab that Hans Steiner, who's one of our professors, has organized of just various other people working with Arduino microcontrollers on either libraries for it or projects of their own. It's kind of like a quilting circle. Basically, it's not a place where anybody's showing each other their work, and it's not a place where any of us are teaching each other how to do anything. It's just a place where we're all working together on our own projects. And
Is the Hack Lab a nonprofit?
Yeah, there's no money involved.
So how does the building get paid for example?
Well, basically, all of us have day jobs, and we pick one of our day jobs each weekend and work at that day job when nobody is around.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. So sometimes the Hack Lab moves.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, your book is all about letting hackers and letting people that tinker in electronics do things with microcontrollers. Can you explain what a microcontroller is for us?
Sure. A microcontroller is basically a very small computer. It's the chip that's at the center of your normal computer, but the ones we use are very simple. They don't do nearly as much as say, the CPU of your computer. But they allow you to attach simple electronic circuits either for sensing the physical world or for making motion or controlling it in some way to the chip, and then you can write a program on your normal laptop and download it to the chip, and then the chip will read the sensors attached to it, and based on the logic you've written for it, control whatever motors or lights or et cetera that you've got attached to it as well.
Okay, let's go ahead and go into an example. I noticed that you've got a monkey on the cover of your book. Do you particularly enjoy monkeys?
I do like monkeys quite a bit. Monkeys are awesome.
Now, explain what this monkey project is.
Sure. The monkey project that you're looking at there is actually one of the first projects in the book. And basically what it is it's a stuffed pink monkey that plays Pong. The way it works is that in the monkey's arms, there are two sensors that sense how much the monkey's arms are bent. Those sensors are attached to a microcontroller, and the microcontroller is just reading that amount of bend as a number from 0 to 1024, or 1023. And then it's sending that into a desktop computer, and the desktop computer is using that the numbers from both of the two sensors to move the paddles in Pong.
So you basically hold onto a monkey and you squeeze its and you bend its arms and that's where your paddle goes.
Exactly.
Is it two people, one paddle for each arm?
The version in the book is just basically one person, with two paddles. But there's also a networked version that I do with my students where basically each person can have their own monkey.
Wait, why would you need two paddles? Oh, I see. You bend one to go one direction. You bend one to go the other direction.
Left arm, right arm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So if you bent them both at the same time, the device wouldn't move.
No, if you bent them both at the same time, your paddles would just go to the top or the bottom of the screen. Oh. Both your paddles go the same place.
Oh, okay. I see. So, but the monkey itself, you could, two people could play pong with each other with one monkey. Is that true?
Yes, if they wanted to sort of tear the monkey apart.
So this really is about kind of interacting with computers in a new way, touching computers. You call this physical computing. Can you explain a little bit more about physical computing?
Sure, yeah. Basically, physical computing is just what you said. It's teaching people to think about the computer as more than just a box, a screen, and a keyboard, to think about all the various ways we have of expressing ourselves physically. And how can we teach computers to read that physical expression and use it in our interaction with them?
If you've got a high school student right now who grew up kind of taking apart their VCR, and she's kind of interested in learning more about microcontrollers and stuff, is this the kind of book that someone at that level that has just like taken things apart and kind of maybe put them back together can go off and run? I mean, how can you use this book?
Definitely, that's the audience for it. Although, actually, I did a first book called Physical Computing that really is more for the beginner level, for people who have no formal electronics training at all. It introduces that stuff a little more in depth. And in this book, we assume you've done a little bit of electronics and have some rudimentary understanding of programming, but maybe you never worked with a microcontroller before, or you've never tried to make a microcontroller communicate across a network before. So I introduce the rudimentary stuff really pretty quickly in this book, and then jump into making microcontrollers talk to each other or to other computers across the net. So it's really kind of designed for people who've already caught a little bit of that bug already and want a lot more.
Very much the maker crowd.
Yeah, very much so.
Now, one thing that's happened, I have a I have an associate's degree in electronics, and I went into the production field in radio broadcasting electronics. So I have some familiarity with designing circuit boards and stepping through that. And now I'm actually at a university doing a program that's pretty similar to yours in some ways. It's an MFA degree instead. But I have run electronics lab and help students with some of the tools that you're talking about in this book. One of the things that's really hit us in the last, 2 years is Arduino and processing and wiring, and these are all tool sets that are used now, which make it a lot easier to incorporate and a lot cheaper to incorporate a microcontroller. So can you tell me what Arduino and wiring boards are?
Sure, yeah. Well, you mentioned processing. I suppose we really should start there, which was a tool that Casey Reese and Ben Fry out of MIT originally made as a programming environment to teach artists and designers and so forth how to program. It stripped away a lot of the technical details that, you know, high-end programming environments had, and just got you coding very quickly. What was nice about it, though, was that it cascaded. In other words, you could learn their very simple language, but their very simple language was based on Java. So once you knew what you were doing, you could start to incorporate Java into your code. You could use a much more powerful language without really having to do a big transition.
You know, and learning Java, one of the geeks is not here right now today, Miles, who's all the time. Ever since we've known each other, he's been trying to teach me Java, and he's taught me. But there's a lot of overhead involved in Java, and you've got to kind of comprehend object-oriented programming first, and the kind of the plateau to get really involved is a while. And processing is completely different. You download this little app, which runs on any operating system, and within moments, you can look at examples and change them and see output to the screen. So it's very, even though it uses Java really as the language, you can slowly step into understanding Java more and more. And it's a great, I think I've done a class on it, and it seems like a great environment to start learning programming.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I think, go ahead.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, one of the things that I think is really nice about processing is that they really took pains to make the syntax of the language simple and clear. So one of the problems I've always had with Java is that, you know, you end up with these very long names for things that you don't need to know all the details of. Whereas with processing, they strip that out. The classic example is in Java, in order to print out something to the screen, you have to say system.out.println hello world. you know, and I don't need to know system out, so they stripped it down to print hello world, you know.
Yeah.
And in wiring and Arduino, you know, the same approach is there to really pick up on that idea of taking pains to keep the language very simple. So that people understand what they're doing when they write a command.
Yeah. So how does having an environment like that help in creating physical objects?
Well, it helps a lot because one of the difficulties often in creating physical objects and in programming microcontrollers that I was talking about before is that there is no physical interface for these chips until you build it. And so you've got kind of a catch-22. You write some code, but you don't know it worked because you've got no way of knowing if the thing you built around it worked, right?
Right. So the microcontroller has no human interface.
That's exactly.
The base level of it. Okay.
And so the first thing about both wiring and Arduino is that they made a nice physical interface for it, in that you plug it into the USB port, it shows up on your computer as a serial port, and you can just download code to it pretty quickly.
And so now Arduino comes with a programming environment for the board, which is actually processing enhanced, if you will.
Yeah, actually the development interface for both wiring and processing is actually, for both wiring and Arduino is based on processing. It's the same code.
Let's get this whole concept down into people's homes a little bit more. A lot of people have cats. Can you tell me one of the projects that you made in this book about cats?
Ah, you hit my favorite one, yeah. So I made a project that allows me to know when my cat is being cute because it sends me an email.
Perfect.
And the way it works is that underneath the cat bed there are sensors, and when the cat goes to the cat bed and sits down on it, the sensors trigger the microcontroller to send a message over the computer to send an email, and I get the email, and then I look at the webcam that's pointed on the cat, and I go, "Aw."
Okay, the webcam's a good trick, because without that, it's a little esoteric. Is the cat
exactly.
cute if you're not in the room? So good, you got a camera. So you built all that?
Yeah.
What are the sensors that you're using to detect a cat's weight?
Well, the sensors underneath it are just what are called force-sensing resistors. And so all I did was I put the four force sensing resistors on a piece of wood, and then I took a second piece of wood and I put little rubber feet on it on top of each of the sensors, and then that slipped underneath the cat bed.
So really, if any pressure happens on that, you get an email that says it's happened. Do you keep on getting email if the cat's stirring around?
No, because the way I wrote the software is that it only looks for the peak. That is, it looks for when the cat actually sits down on it, and then when it doesn't do anything until it changes when the cat comes off it.
And when the cat comes off, is it the same type of email, or does it say, cat's finished being cute?
No, it doesn't send a mail after the cat gets off.
Okay. So you gotta be on top of your email.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good. And so the board that you used for this is Arduino?
Yeah, I used an Arduino with that one. The project is fairly early in the book, so that one is an Arduino going into a desktop computer to do the network connection.
Right.
Later on in the book, I introduce tools for doing the network connection without a desktop computer.
So what this looks like is a little program running on your computer that's listening to your USB port, and an Arduino board, which is going to send a command to the USB port if anything triggers that switch.
That's right.
So the software that's receiving the commands on your computer has to be running to get for this to work, and then it just uses your normal email to send email.
Actually, it doesn't use your normal email. It uses... that one does use your normal email. There's a first... Sometimes I get the projects mixed up. Yes, what you said.
Okay, good. All right, so let me see. What else do I want to... Well, let's go on another project. What's another... I mean, you mentioned that one. What? Let's get a little more complicated. So that has to use a computer. What kind of standalone stuff do you have in
Sure, well, the next one that follows on from there is I'm built... a networked air quality sensor. And the way this one works is I didn't want to build a whole network of the sensors themselves. I knew that there were plenty of them on the net, and on, for example, the NOAA site, the National Atmospheric site, there's all kinds of air quality data. So I built a little project that takes the data from the air quality site and brings it directly into the microcontroller and sets an old antique meter, like a voltage meter. So you can see this needle moving up and down on this old meter to let you know what the air quality is around you.
So you're not actually doing the air sensing. You're relying on the experts to do that.
Exactly.
That makes sense. So you're basically... So this device actually functions as a do-you-really-want-to-go-outside-today kind of device?
Basically, yeah.
And does air quality fluctuate a lot in New York?
It does go up and down a little bit, yeah, particularly in the summer.
Hey, Ben and Sean, this is the project that he's talking about. That's the meter that tells him his air quality. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
It's a nice looking
cool.
meter. I mean, meter. This is one of those things that you're, you know, we have a lot of disposal concepts in our world, and it seems to me that the more you can kind of reuse things, the better. Like this meter, for example, is beautiful, but there's no way a new product's going to be designed with that meter. It's too expensive and all that. So this kind of captures that idea of if you like an old meter or something, incorporate into a new project, make something new.
Exactly. I mean, I really do think that one of the big problems with all of the glory of physical computing is we're making a huge mess as we do it.
Yeah.
So the more we can sort of repurpose old pieces like that, I think it's easy. Also, just aesthetically, it's nice. I mean, you can do things with these beautiful things that people spent so much time to build that, you know, it's a shame to throw them out.
Yeah, definitely. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. We're going to focus around making things talk, the book that we're talking with, the book called Making Things Talk. We have the author, Tom Igo, on from NYU, and we're discussing how to make electronic projects that communicate with your computer and the internet. And we're going to be taking calls like that. So if you're interested in the subject to ask us questions, please feel free to do so. The phone number is again 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. The geeks today are Sean Cleveland, Ben Jaffe, I'm Lyle Troxell. We have some backup support from Alex and Dee Dee through chat, and we're talking with Tom Igo. KUSP co-sponsors the Santa Cruz Ballet Theater's 25th anniversary season production of The Nutcracker. The holiday magic of The Nutcracker will be presented at the Santa Cruz City Auditorium with a live symphony orchestra conducted by John Larry Granger. Performances are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, December 14th, 15th, and 16th. Tickets can be purchased online at scbt.org or by calling the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium box office at 420-5260. And my niece, Clarissa, is in this production, so you have to go see it. You listen to Central Coast Public Radio. Stay tuned with KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. We are taking your calls with questions and comments of electronics, personal devices, making things happen, making things talk. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Tom, let's talk a little bit about the program that you're at. Dee Dee Hubbard went there, and she's a good friend of ours. And from what I understand, it's a very dynamic environment where people are creating new pieces of art all the time. What captures you about that space?
I think what captures me about it is the fact that it's just got such a really great energy. I mean, as you mentioned, it's a two-year grad program. There's 230 students. There's about 115 students every year. The whole of the program exists in one floor of the building at NYU, and so they're really on top of each other all the time. And so they really get very good at collaborating with each other, working closely side by side, sharing information and parts and all of that. And we take people from all different programs and walks of life. We don't say that you need a certain technical background or a certain theoretical background or anything like that. So you get people who've done no technology whatsoever, but have said, you know what, whatever I'm doing in my life, I can see a need for this stuff, and I want to do it hands-on. And so they just jump into it. And, you know, I'm constantly surprised by the things the students come up with, and it's just delightful for that reason.
Can you give us an example of a student project that happens at Tisch?
Yeah, one of the student projects going on right now, for example, Raphael Zollinger and Evrim Sahin have taken sensors, the wireless sensors that we're using, wireless radios that, in fact, I read about in the book. There are these little XP radios, and they've attached them to sensors to see what kind of mechanical energy they can get off of the doors, off of the tools, the power tools, off of anything that moves in the building, so that they can sense what kind of energy they could be capturing to use to power electronics around the floor. And then they've taken that, and from the wireless sensors, they go onto the internet and they graph it and log it. So they've got a really nice picture of the various energy that's being essentially wasted off the various movements we do around the floor.
Are they capturing the energy to use it, or are they just censoring it to see how much waste there is?
At the moment, they're just capturing to find out what's out there. They're hoping eventually to be able to use it. But the first phase is just to see what's possible.
I remember hearing statistics years ago about telephones in the United States, and that, you know, that in most handsets there's a weight added to the telephone to actually make it weigh something. And because it's really just very light. And so the weight in there is like this, you know, piece of brass or something that's heavy, and it's in every single handset in the world, except for the ones that are portable that have a battery instead. And the amount of waste was just kilojoules of waste happening all the time. So it's interesting to see that it, as a project, to kind of detect it and see how much there really is.
Well, that's the thing, you know. I mean, we've been running a class on sustainable energy taught by Jeff Fetterson, and we've really been trying to just get across to, first of all, what energy is and how it's getting used. I mean, one of the things that struck me listening to you guys earlier on was you said 95% of the mail being sent is spam. Well, you know, it takes electronic energy to send mail.
Yeah.
And so it'd be really interesting to sit down and calculate exactly how much energy is getting wasted by all that spam.
Yeah, if you could take all the expense of mail servers, and just 95% of that expense is actually waste.
Mm-hmm.
We have a call from Santa Cruz. Jackie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering, a number of people are still getting ill from the spray every time the wind blows, and I wondered if there would be any way to set up a sensor to tell you when there was checkmate in the air from the wind blowing from high trees.
So the chemical being used to get rid of the moth infestation. I don't know, but Tom, if you're aware of it, but California, especially in this area, we're getting a lot of spraying to get rid of a moth that's infesting, I believe, apple trees. Is that the right?
Yes, thing? It's like.
And so the question is, can you make a detector, since you have an air pollution detector that can do that? Tom, can you help us with that?
Yes, theoretically, it'd be possible. I don't know the particular chemicals that are in the spray, but what you'd need to do is you need to find a gas sensor that detects those particular sensors and then attach that to a microcontroller to read the levels on it, and there you go.
So a lot of these devices are something you have to buy. Like that little sensor is probably a pretty specific sensor that senses certain chemicals, and that might be an expensive item. That could be up to $300 or $400 just for that
could
one
be.
Item.
You never really know, though. I mean, I did a very similar project in the book, actually, when I was sensing paint fumes in my shop, and the sensor for that was, I think it was only around $20, but the same company sold them some that were up to $2,000, so, you know, it varies depending on the quality of the sensor and the detail you need.
Right.
It may be with a project like you're talking about that all you need to know is, you know, the spray is high today, stay inside.
Right.
You don't necessarily do you know exactly how many parts per million or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
Jackie, it seems like a great, I remember there was a lot of talk prior to the spraying happening, and the idea of saying, could we have, you know, portable monitors as part of the project seems like a great idea, because you could alleviate some of the concerns that people have. I mean, for example, if someone gets a cold and it happens to happen the day of the spraying, what was the cause of it, you know? And without having a sensor of some kind, you don't really know.
Yeah. So there was a project that...
start to do this? I mean, where would you find that sensor?
Well, that's a bit of research you'd have to do, and I don't have an answer for that. I don't think Tom would either, necessarily. Tom, where do you find the paint sensors?
I found those online at a company called FigaroSensor.com sells a lot of gas sensors. But you're right, it would just take some time to find exactly the right sensor for that.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye, Jackie.
Yeah, Rick just let us know that it's not really a pesticide. It's more of a chemical that interferes with reproduction. You know, like a pheromone, like a pheromone that confuses.
Right. I don't want to get into the whole discussion about that, of course, because that's a big can of worms, can of moth larva. Okay, but let's go on with the book at hand. Hang on a second. You just found something, Ben?
Yeah, I just found the phone number for the light brown apple moth project, the phone banks. And the phone number that you can call maybe to get more information, maybe they have a solution or know where you could find some sensors, 1-800-491-1899, and that's the LBA, the Light Brown Apple Moth Project.
Okay, so Tom, we talked about sensors of touch, and we talked about sensors of gas detection, which is kind of cool. What about, like, other types of detection? What other sensors can you use in your projects?
Sure, one of my favorites, actually, is the tilt sensor, the accelerometer.
Oh, yeah.
And, everybody loves the accelerometer. It's basically what makes the Wii work.
The Wii remote control, right?
Exactly. You know, it's just a sensor that senses a changing acceleration. Of course, we've got acceleration due to gravity, so when you tilt something, it changes the gravity on that thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the projects I built in the book with an accelerometer was a seesaw that you stand on, and you tilt back and forth, again, to play Pong. In this case, I made a networked version of Pong where you could have multiple people logging in over the Internet.
So you're basically two people are having seesaws, and they just lean to the left, lean to the right, and their paddle moves back and forth?
Yeah, although it can be more than two people in the game we built. It can be up to 15 or 16 people, basically. Oops. Each person has their own paddle, and they just log in and play.
And it's all one game?
Mm-hmm.
I want to see a Pong with 15 players. How does that work?
It's pretty chaotic, but basically the way it works is that every time a new player logs in, it adds a new paddle on one side of the screen or the other, and it just alternates sides. This is actually the midterm assignment for the class that I teach using the book called Networked Objects. And what I do is I give them the code to work with, and I tell them, I'll be running the server. Your job is to make the physical paddle. So the same code can work with many different physical manifestations. For example, I've got the tilt sensor that we talked about with the seesaw. I had a student last year who did a great project where basically he had a camera pointed himself, and he opened up his shirt and moved back and forth, and it detected his white body moving against a black screen.
And that was his. And that was the detection.
That was his paddle. Yeah, his body was his paddle. But so anyway, when you've got many people logging into the game, you end up with essentially a cooperative version of Pong, because you've got eight players on a side, and each one has to get the paddle to the other side, but they can also interfere with each other, because if somebody's in front of you, when you hit the ball back, it hits their paddle and bounces back to you.
Oh, cool. So a little bit like playing volleyball when two people are kind of bumping into each other.
Exactly.
I want to invite people to call in. Go ahead and give us your idea for a personal project, and Tom can help us through how you'd build it. Like we just talked about a gas detection device, and that's mostly about the sensor itself. But think of another project. If you've been thinking about being an inventor for a while and want to share your idea, give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We have some great links up on geekspeak.org, specifically to Tom Igoe's site, where he has resources about the stuff in this book, links to these different software packages and the hardware that we're talking about. The book is called Making Things Talk by O'Reilly. It's part of the Make Projects series of books. O'Reilly has, of course, Make Magazine as well. We've had him on the show many times. I want to say that this book could very much be in a classroom environment where students are just using these projects as examples to create things. Even in a high school, possibly in a junior high level of classwork. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's really what I wrote it for. Even though I'm teaching at a graduate school, the level of technology is no more than you really learn in, say, 8th or 9th grade in many ways.
Well, all of us learn this technology in 8th or 9th grade?
Okay, maybe not all of us. Most of us tend to sleep through that class.
That's the science class, right, when you learn
electronics. Exactly. I think what it comes down to is that when you reach the point where you're in your mid-20s, all of a sudden you've got interest in those things that you slept through in 8th grade.
Are you finding that the sensors that, heat sensors and motion detectors and things of that nature, are they decreasing in price over the years? I mean, you've been doing this for a while.
Excuse me. Yeah, I am noticing definitely some price drops, and I'm also noticing more availability because people know where to find them. One of the biggest challenges I find is back to where we're talking about the gas sensor, is finding out where to get them, because the companies that make these aren't used to selling to the general public.
Right.
But there are a number of people who are starting to say, well, you know what? It's worthwhile to sell to the general public, so what I'm going to do is buy those from the industrial vendors and package them in a nice way.
Like SparkFun does.
Yeah, SparkFun has really made their entire business off of that. I was talking with Nathan Seidel, who runs the company. He said, who knew I could make an entire business making breakout circuit boards? But
yeah.
He did.
Yeah, yes. SparkFun.com, a great site. I'll add to the GeekSpeak site as well. Well, Ndidi is, through chat, suggests that a good project would be to put accelerometers on her... how do you say it, Tom?
Accelerometers.
Thank you. On her skates.
She's hit my other great passion, roller derby. Dee Dee is a member of the Ohio Roller Girls, and we're very proud of her for that. I actually have dreamed about this project a little bit myself, the idea of putting a speed sensor on a roller girl, because, one of the things that they're very proud of is being able to go faster than each other. That's the whole part of the game. You would have to basically build the project so that the sensor had a battery on it and had a radio on it so that you could send the data back wirelessly off of the skater. The biggest problem, though, I think, I thought this through this problem a lot, is that the electronics you're putting on the girl's body, it's a big lump, right?
Right.
And you've got to be able to put it somewhere that so that when she gets hit by another skater, it doesn't cause a bruise.
Right.
You know?
And you also want to be on a part of her body that doesn't change a lot of momentum compared to her all of her body. Like on
exactly.
a foot wouldn't work exactly because as you throw your foot around, the accelerometer, it would show a lot more acceleration than
true.
The person's going through.
Although, you know, being able to look at the pattern of that, you'd really get a sense of her gait.
That's true.
You know, I thought perhaps the best place to do that might be on the top of the helmet because, first of all, when she goes down, the helmet's there to protect her anyway. And second of all, if you look at a lot of the skaters, the place where they tend to decorate the most is on top of the helmet. So
it's already kind of defined as the space that's a good place to customize.
Yeah, that could work.
But, of course, the device also would have to be in such a way that it wouldn't bust off and cause hazardous on the track.
Yeah, exactly. And, again, that could be done. It would just be a matter of, you know, protecting it very carefully. Maybe you wrap it in rubber or something like that
right.
so it bounces off.
So describe to me what you're talking about. When you're talking about wireless, what wireless technology would you use?
Well, what I would probably use are these radios we were talking about earlier. They're called XBs. They're a little Zigbee radio. And Zigbee is just a protocol for doing networked radios. What's nice about them is that most radios for digital communication like this, they basically communicate one-to-one. In other words, one radio speaking to a second radio, kind of like Bluetooth. The thing that's nice about these ones is that they can communicate one-to-many very easily.
Is this the device that's inside is this the Nike iPod thing?
I think they're using a radio similar to it, though. I'm not sure they're necessarily using Zigbee.
Mm-hmm.
Similar idea, though, yes. And the nice thing about the radios we've been using is that they actually have their own circuitry to attach sensors directly to, so you don't need to attach a microcontroller as well.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. They're fairly cheap. They're like $20. So
they're just kind of a gateway device that just takes the signals electronically and makes them wireless.
Exactly. I'm using right now on a project I'm doing to make a mechanical clock. And so I've got the radio attached to the pendulum and an accelerometer attached to the inputs of the radio. And so it's just sending me back the data about the pendulum swinging back and forth.
Oh, cool. We have a call from SoCal. Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
This is really neat stuff, and I'm kind of overflowing with ideas of things to do. But my question is, I've got two college-age kids, and I wondered if you can recommend a Christmas present sort of starter kit or some reasonably inexpensive way to get started.
Get them the book.
just a book, or is there hardware that you can pick up that's a good starting place?
And I remember as a kid getting the 151 electronic kit from Radio Shack.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that kind of stuff is really fun. Do they have modern versions of that?
Well, actually, in the book, we list the part numbers for all the projects, but one of the best starter kits that I've seen out there right now, LadyAda.net, Adafruit.net, rather, is selling a starter kit for the Arduino that includes your basic sensors to start off with and all the parts you need to do the first few projects.
Can you slow that down again? What's the site?
Adafruit.net, Adafruit.net. It's run by Limor Freed, and she does a lot of nice kits to get people started with projects.
Okay, Adafruit.com, did you say?
.net.
Adafruit.net. And how do you spell Arduino?
Arduino.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll have these URLs up on GeekSpeak.org,
oh, good. Okay.
So we can go to one place for them.
Good, thanks a lot.
Thank you for the call. Bye-bye. All right, so let's step through. One of the other sensors is a distance sensing device. Can you give an example of these distance sensors, what you can do with them?
Sure. There's a few different ones out there, the distance ranging sensors. Basically, what they do is they send out a signal, either an ultrasonic signal or an infrared signal, and they wait for it to bounce back, and they measure the strength of the return signal. We've used them for a whole lot of things. Actually, one of my students this semester did a really lovely project. They built you know the Lomo cameras?
No, I don't.
The Holga cameras. They're basically a really cheaply made camera. I think developed in the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Photographers love them because they're always badly made, and they create an image quality that you just can't get with something that's really well machined. You get these very idiosyncratic photos.
And that's good?
That's good, yes, because you get more character to the images in the same way that sometimes noise can really add something to guitar playing, right?
Okay.
So these students made a digital version of a Holga. They took a bunch of photocells and they mounted it on a board and they attempted to make their own digital camera. And inside the digital camera, they realized they weren't going to be able to make the whole array of thousands of cells, so they had a little arm that they moved around, an XY arm, an arm that moved in two dimensions. And they needed to detect the position of that arm in a grid. And so they had two of these distance sensors, one looking from the top and one looking from the side, to measure the position of the arm in space.
What was on the arm?
On the arm was the actual photocells that detected the light. So basically they had made a big box, and the box was a pinhole camera. There was a tiny hole on one end, and on the other end was a blank wall with this arm that had the photocells on it, so that basically you'd look at a part of the image from the pinhole by moving the arm around.
Very cool. So you had like a floating sensor in there, and it was just kind of randomly getting stuff?
It was not randomly getting stuff, because you were actually moving it to see the part of the image you wanted to see, and they were figuring out where you were moving by using these distance sensors.
So if you want to take an actual photo, you need to move it around a lot, and it would kind of sum it up? Oh, that's cool. Very active electronic device.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one thing that's bothering me all the time is most of my devices do not have GPS built in, so I want to make a GPS detection thing so I can add information to, like, when I take a picture. I want to just trigger that. And you can buy GPS chips. How complicated is it to use a GPS antenna device thing?
Well, it's not too complex to use from a programming standpoint, because really the GPS signal, all the GPS devices will spit that out to you as a line of text. But the difficulty is, most of the time, being able to pick up a GPS signal, as you probably know. If you're living, actually it's probably a lot easier in SoCal than it is here in New York, but GPS is basically just a bunch of satellites over the planet, and you've got a receiver that's picking up the signal from at least 3 to 6 different satellites and calculating its position based on the distance from each of those satellites. The problem is that anytime you don't have a direct line of sight to the satellites, you don't get an accurate picture of the distance. So here in New York, for example, when you've got tall buildings shadowing your position, you never really get the GPS. So that's really, I think, the biggest difficulty in using GPS. To use the devices themselves, it's, like I said, it's fairly simple. You connect the GPS device to either a microcontroller or a desktop or laptop computer, and it brings you in the latitude and longitude as a text string.
Who's interested in this kind of stuff? What kind of person?
In GPS stuff?
In your book.
I would say mostly geeks, obviously, but I see a lot of artists who want to make interactive work, who maybe want to make sculptures that respond to the audience. I've had, the last few years at ITP, we've had a number of students interested in occupational therapy. We had one student who did a really lovely project where she wanted to be able to measure her patient's progress better than a lot of the tools that were out there. She could either pay for tens of thousands of dollars of expensive tools, or she could make her own. She's an occupational therapist, and she came to ITP to learn how to build her tools.
What kind of stuff was she making to help people heal or do better?
She was working on patients with joint injuries, and so she wanted to be able to measure the range of motion of their joints. So one of the devices she made was a very simple device that you just strap onto the elbow, and it measures the bend of the elbow. And
therefore how much the joint is going.
Right, and sends that back into her computer, and she wrote a little program to keep track of how much you're bending it over time.
Just to count it, or how much actual bend is happening?
Well, to count how much bend is happening and to keep track of that over your subsequent visits to her office.
Oh, that's cool.
That's really cool. My father just had his knee replaced, so bending his knee is really important. That's a nice application to figure out how his progress is.
Yeah, you should wire him up a Christmas present. Yeah.
And a lot of times it's not just purely informational you need on these things. I mean, I think what the student in question, Pinky, did really well was she made a tool that played music back about the bend as you did it. So, for example, you'd hear it doing a glissando up the piano, and the further you'd bend, the further up the pitch you'd get. And so it became kind of a game to really work your limb. And so as a result, the patient tried more.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Bill, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I've got an art project in mind, and so I don't know too much about the electricity behind it. But what I'd like to do is set up like a shadow box on a wall with a piece of plexiglass. And when people would walk by, a light behind the plexiglass would go on. And when they walked past, it would go off.
So just the panel that lights up as you get near it?
Correct, yeah.
All right, so that would be a motion sensor, right, Tom?
Potentially, yeah. The question I've got, though, is when exactly do you want to trigger it about their intention? So is it when they're paying attention to it, or do you want to surprise them as they walk by? Or do you want to do it when their back is facing it? When do you want to detect them?
As they're approaching it. So in other words, maybe about a foot away from the actual piece. Mm-hmm. And then it would go off about a foot after they left.
Okay, so yeah, you'd use a motion detector and a microcontroller, and what you'd do is you'd sense when they got close, and then a few seconds later you would turn it off, right?
With a foot or so range, what would you use, like a sonar... ultrasonic or use an infrared?
Is this indoors or outdoors?
It would be indoors, like in an art gallery.
In an art gallery, I would probably use one of the infrareds for that range. I like the ultrasonics for longer distance because they can usually go up to about 6 meters. But you can get some of the infrared ones that really read in about a 10 to 80 centimeter range. It'd be perfect for this.
And then it just triggers when it happens. You don't have to say, well, what is the range and figure that out mathematically.
Right.
So when I go to look for it, when I go to look for it, what exactly am I looking for? Infrared sensor?
I think you've got one of these in the book, don't you?
I do, yes. It's called an infrared ranger. The one I would use is the Sharp GP2D12.
Sharp.
It's Project 14, and it's on page 266 of Making Things Talk. And
Making Things Talk?
Making Things Talk by O'Reilly Publishing.
Great.
Author is Tom Igo. And what other things would he need for this project?
The other things he'd need for this project, if he was building it like we did in the book, is he would need a microcontroller, and he would need a relay of some sort to turn on and off the light behind it. Is the light behind it going to be just like a normal incandescent light bulb, or do you know what kind of light it is?
Well, I don't have a clear idea, but it would not be a light bulb. It was something like you see in these little solar things that people put on their walkways. That come on at night,
right?
Yeah, that's probably an incandescent light bulb. The question, I guess, is that if it's a fluorescent, you've got to have some kind of ballast that produces high voltage, and sometimes those don't turn on really quickly. So you kind of want a device that's going to turn on fast, and a normal incandescent light bulb is probably going to be the
And would there have to be some sort of electrical power associated with this?
Yeah, you'd have to plug this into the wall, wouldn't you say, Tom?
Yeah, to get it really bright, you would probably want to use a 120-volt light bulb, and then you'd really need to plug it into the wall. That's why I was thinking about the relay.
I'd say getting an Arduino board and getting the parts for this and the relay and the transformer of some kind, you could probably do this whole project for under $200.
I think that's about right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's just off the top of our head, though, Bill.
Great. Thank you very much.
Good luck on your art project.
Thanks
a lot. Good luck.
I think that... I think, Tom, we're going to have to start up a little hackers group here in Santa Cruz because I love helping people with this kind of stuff. It's so much fun.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks this morning were Sean Cleveland and Ben Jaffe. Support by Dee Dee Hubbard and Alex Slias over chat. I'm Lyle Troxell. Answering the phones were Rick Philman. Our guest today is Tom Igo. He is a professor at ITP at NYU. You can learn all about this by going to geekspeak.org. Tom, thank you. Oh, and the book is Making Things Talk by O'Reilly Media. Thank you, Tom, for being here on Geek Speak today.
Thank you.
I look forward to doing other projects with you, or at least talking about projects with you in the near future.
I think it'll be a lot of fun, definitely.
Thanks again, Tom. Bye-bye.
Good luck. Take care.
Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Socal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. We're broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Otto, on the web at kusp.org. For GeekSpeak and KUSP, I'm Lyle Troxell.
You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.